What I would like to speak about today is this whole subject about which I have just completed a book titled Manifest Your Destiny, The Nine Spiritual Principles for Getting Whatever You Want. And when I set out to write it, I experienced a little more doubt than I really like to admit to, since I've written about how to banish doubt in our lives and to create that knowing within. And yet, I was moving in a direction in my life that I didn't even know if I was qualified to write about or capable of producing anything in this area. And it's like my friend Susan Jeffers has a title of a book that I've always liked that says, Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And I must admit to feeling a bit of just anxiousness about taking on this subject before I wrote Your Sacred Self and Real Magic and You'll See It When You Believe It, all of which were books that sort of got me off of the path that I had been on, which is, if you followed my works over the past couple of decades, you have seen a shift, a transformation, a movement away from focusing on managing your emotions and being psychologically more sound and more centered and not being victimized and all of these kinds of things that are very useful and helpful, I believe. But when you start out and get on this path, things begin to happen in your life. And there were shifts that were taking place. And they started for me when I actually sat down to write Gifts from Icus, which is a novel, a parable that I wrote 18 years ago. And it was really a joke. It was really, I was just writing a little funny satire. I started out as a satire. It was based upon a story that I had conceived in my mind of another place, a place where people would be neurotic like we are, except that they had to be because their reality dictated that. And I created this, and it was all for this one, it was a punchline. And the punchline was going to be the last line of the book. And I'll tell you what that punchline was in a moment. And the planet was Uranus, and the place, the woman that was on this planet was named was Icus, which was just my daughter who had just been born, who is now 15. Her name is Sky. Her name spelled backwards, which is Icus, E-Y-K-I-S. Only I just added in there. And a visitor just went to this planet and saw that they turned on the TV and there was this woman newscaster, her name was Icus, who was giving the anxiety attack report on the for the weekend right after the weather. You know, like after the storms come in and you have to prepare for that, she'd say, anxiety will be coming in, you know, and get out your Valium, get out your Librium, because there'll be heavy doses of anxiety coming in on the weekends. And this was a place where anxiety really did attack. And so people had anxiety attacks. And I did this whole thing on guilt is something that you have to have on this planet, because it allows you, when you get so much of it, to go into rewind, and then you get to do it over, and so guilt sends you back and gets you to do things over. And then this lady, Icus, this divine being, comes to Earth, and of course she can't figure out why people are neurotic by choice. When anxiety doesn't really attack. And being guilty doesn't allow you to go into rewind and all of these things. And it was just sort of my little satire, just another way of presenting the message. And this is what really got me started on this path. And then she goes back to Uranus, but before she goes, she leaves with these secrets of the universe, these great secrets. That and there are 17 of them, and I wrote about each one of them. And she says, as she is leaving, you have a choice to either adopt these and make your world work, or to, to live the neurotic life that you're continuing. And then I was going to summarize the book, and I was going to call the book, the title of which was going to be that last punchline, which was, if you want to be happy, get your head out of Uranus, which... And I had a wonderful picture for the cover of the book. I had a drawing. I had a yoga master who had posed for it. And it was... And that was my idea, and it was really just sort of a joke, just a fun thing that I was going to do. And it turned out that people bought it, and it was very successful, and everybody took it very seriously. And so after that, I got into this area of... I had written a book about raising children, and then I began to look at my own life in a kind of a different way, and where I was going, what I wanted for myself, and what was happening in my relationships and so on. And I wrote this book called You'll See It When You Believe It. And I couldn't get it published. I mean, I had written books that had all been huge bestsellers, and publishers were always anxious to take anything that I had written and so on. And yet my publisher, when they read that, they said, no, this is not a direction that we're going in. This is not something that the world is going to accept. It's too far out there. It's too weird. And so I went to a different publisher, and I changed publishers, went to William Morrow, and I did it without an advance, which is probably not a big deal to you, but when you've got 8 kids, it's a very big deal, and this is how you make a living. And paid for it all myself, and put the whole thing together, and then they got behind it. I had a wonderful editor, and then... That really got me going on this journey of looking at these principles, these spiritual principles that that this church stands for and has stood for as long as I have been associated with it, which goes back to 1975, when it was just a little classroom over on the east side of Detroit at Regina High School, when Jack asked me if he could make a tape series based upon your erroneous sounds, which a lot of people thought was a sex book. He's right. You'll see it when you believe it. He wanted me to write a sex book. And a lot of people thought I already had done that, you know, with erroneous sounds. And I remember going into a bookstore in Des Moines, Iowa, and seeing my picture in that little paperback in the middle of all the rest of the pornographic books. And this whole section of books, you know. Do Me, Do Me, Do Me, and Debbie Does Dallas. And The Pizza Man Always Delivers, I think, was one. And there was my little face in your erroneous sounds, right in the middle of all of that. But I didn't want to write that, and I didn't want to write a business book, and I didn't want to write a diet book. I wanted to have my writing reflect what was happening with me in my life. And that was, of course, followed by Real Magic, which was sort of taking on this idea of being able to create miracles in our lives. And then Your Sacred Self, which was really my effort to write about the triumph of the higher or the sacred part of us over the ego. And I'll talk somewhat about that today. But then, of course, the question always is for the left brain and for the ego part of us, what's next? Where are you going? What are you going to do now? Are you going to retire? Are you going to stop writing? Have you said everything that you know? And so on. And then magical things always seem to happen when you let go and you let God into your life. And you stop questioning and you stop demanding and you stop insisting. And you surrender. And in this process of doing that, whatever it is that you need to do on your journey will become very evident to you. And the right people will start to show up, and the right things will be there for you, and the financing will be there, and all of that. All of that seems to work. And in the process of preparing for Your Sacred Self, I read some spiritual literature. I immersed myself in A Course in Miracles. And I read Madame Blavatsky, who was very influential for a lot of writers of the 20th century. A Russian lady who lived in the last century predicted that there would be an incredibly revolutionary experience, a revolution, if you will, on the planet that would transcend any of the revolutions that had ever occurred before. It would make the agricultural revolution and the Renaissance and the industrial revolution and even the technological and informational revolution, all of which she predicted, dwarfed by comparison with the spiritual revolution that would be ushered in the last 25 years of the millennium and in the first 11 years of the next millennium, is what she said in the secret doctrine. And she said the leaders of this revolution would not be people in power, but indeed would come out of the masses. They would be school teachers, they would be singers, they would be dancers, they would be physicians, they would be attorneys, they would be lawyers and people who just regular folks, cab drivers, whatever, who would, and the groundswell would come from within, and then the leadership would begin to get it, rather than the other way around. And that, I think about that and what Madame Blavatsky said when I read this, and when I wrote Erroneous Zones in 1975, I had never heard of Madame Blavatsky, nor read any of her work. And I thought about the changes, the shifts that have taken place on the planet. And I don't want to take the time to go into all of them, but you know, the dismantling of the Soviet Union and the apartheid and all of the kinds of changes, the really dramatic changes that I've talked about here before, which if anybody would have tried to predict 10 or 15 years ago, they would have been laughed at. You know, that there would be a man in prison and who would probably become the man of the century in South Africa, who wasn't even allowed to be photographed and had no visitors for over a quarter of a century. And he would not only be released, but he would become the democratically elected president of a black-white coalition government in South Africa. Just absolutely unheard of. And this is like a speck ago. This is just a moment ago. Because one of the great teachings, I think, that we have to understand in our own lives and collectively is that there's nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come. And when that idea is there and it's present and it's fluid and it's allowed to flow, then nothing can stop it. And then I take a look at these changes in reading her work. I think about who have been the spokespeople. I'm always amused in election years when the people who are running for the higher offices proclaim themselves to be our leaders and act as if they really are the ones who are leading us. And I am, and all the commercials are a leader for our times, and this is the person that's leading us. And I always wonder where they ever got the idea that they were the leaders, because they just happened to be in an elective office. It's sort of like if you had a nice home and you had people that you hired to come in and help you out with it and take care of it, and you paid them to do that, and you just said, look, you're our servants. Take care of our home. And I don't want to bother with all of these finances over here, so here's the money, and you take care of this and make sure that everything is running okay. And then after a while, they said, well, we need more of your money, and we're not going to give any of it back to you. And you said, wait a minute. This is my money. And the servant said to you, no. We're going to tell you what you can do with it. And all of a sudden, there's like this whole shifting around taking place in your house. And you're out there working and doing all of the things to make the house work. And you got these other people who you're giving your money to telling you that they're your leaders. And there's like this twisting around of what leadership really is. You know, I mean, when you think of the revolution that took place in ancient Greece, who were the leaders of the democratic revolution in Greece? Were they the elected officials? You know, or who do you think of when you think of Greece? You think of Aristotle, don't you? Don't you think of Socrates? You think of and Plato and the people who wrote down the Hippocrates? I mean, these were not people who were elected to office. I mean, do you look up who was the president of Greece? And who were the leaders of the Renaissance? You know, the leaders of the Renaissance were the Da Vincis, the Medicis, the artists, the artisans, the people who were expressing the value of the human spirit in their writing and in their work and in their inventions and so on. The leaders weren't the people who were running for office, who were passing rules. And this whole idea of who the leaders are on the planet today. See, it's like the real leadership shift is going to be in the consciousness that is in here. And there's an awful lot of people, when you go back to 15, 20, 30 years ago and look at the kinds of changes that were taking place. Just like simple little changes, like young men letting their hair grow a little longer, you know, or starting to put an earring in their ear and things like this. And remember the outrage. I mean, how people were just so freaked out. Over, oh, my God, they've got hair growing over their ear. I'm very sensitive to this issue, you know. And they're going to wear an earring, and they're going to get a tattoo, or they're going, you know, these were things that we were just so. And now, you know, the same people that were so obsessed with that and so concerned with that, you know, today, you know, I mean, they were called, these were sissies, these guys who let their hair grow a little bit long, remember? And now you watch the National Football League, and these burly mastodons of masculinity have their hair underneath their helmet, you know, and they got earrings and so on. And it's like it's the same thing with the consciousness that this afternoon's seminar is about. It's like the people, the rest of the people, you are the leaders. The consciousness is the leader, and the rest of the people will begin to follow and come along this road, along this path, once we get it paved. But right now it's bumpy, and it's got pebbles on it, and it's a little bit painful and a little bit difficult. And it's a big part of what I want to share with you and talk to you about today. It's like if you want to make the changes in your life that are going to create a higher level of awareness in you, you've got to really, what I call, you've got to leave the tribe. You've got to get out of the tribe. You got to leave tribal consciousness behind. And the tribe is really nothing that you should be angry about. The tribe has been very supportive, helpful in your development. But the tribe is like your immediate family and your extended family and your communities and your organizations, your educational organizations, your religious organizations, your whatever it is, these groups that that you're a member of by just the virtue of the fact that you showed up in them. And the question of whether you're going to evolve is not really the issue, because the tribe will evolve. Tribes do evolve. We have our tribe as a people. We have come to a recognition about things like racial inequities, slavery. I mean, it's taken a long time, and there's still a lot of work to do, but there's a recognition that this is just not the way to go, and we're not going to behave this way. And there was an awful lot of people who sacrificed a lot along that path. The shifts away from, for example, world wars as a way of solving our disputes. I mean, the tribe has ultimately come to a conclusion that this isn't going to work anymore. I mean, these things that we have building, these weapons that we're building and aiming at each other, if we ever fire one, we're going to kill ourselves. So we can't even use the weapons that we've created because we all breathe the same air. And the winds will blow back the same toxic stuff we put into the atmosphere that we're aiming at someone else. So we've come to, so the tribe will come, and even with nuclear weapons, I mean, when I first started speaking on this stage, and it's about let's build more and more weapons. I often ask audiences, is there anybody in Russia that you don't like? Is there anybody in the Soviet Union that you really hate? You know, some commie grandmother over there that just really bugs you, you know? With tennis shoes on, who's got like signs that protesting or whatever. You know, we spent something like 30% of our gross national product for almost 30 years to build weapons aimed at all of these people. And every audience I've ever asked the question, is there anybody in the Soviet Union that you hate? Nobody's ever raised a hand. So we spent $3 or 4 trillion of all of our gross national product to build weapons to aim at people that nobody dislikes. It's an insane kind of thing that we've allowed to take. It's because we've let the servants, you know, take over and let them believe that they're leaders. You know, and they say, look, they're dangerous. They're going to come after you. This is really bad. These guys are, you know. And the problem is, of course, that we haven't learned to love each other. We haven't understood what the Sioux Indians meant when they said that no tree has branches so foolish as to fight among themselves. And once we get that and know that, that the tree would collapse were it to have its branches fighting among itself, and that we are all just buds on a tree called humanity. And we're moving in that direction. I mean, we used to talk about how can we build more nuclear weapons, and now we're talking about how can we get rid of them. I mean, but What I'm saying to you is the tribe will evolve at a certain pace. And the question isn't whether you're going to evolve. You will evolve. The question is, at what speed are you going to evolve? If you choose to evolve with the tribe, then you have made a choice to do it very, 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 very slowly. And if you want to turn left, and all you want to do is turn left, but the tribe is heading straight or turning right, you're not going to be able to do it. You see, because the mantra of the tribe is, but what will they think? But what will they think? And you have to learn, in order to enter into this new territory, this territory of being able to become a manifester in your life, which is what the theme of this seminar is about, learning to manifest, to be able to place your attention on what it is that you would like to attract and have show up in your life, and know within that it will, to be able to take on the teachings that Jesus talked about in the New Testament through St. John, that even the least among you can do all that I have done, and even greater things, that you have within you this phenomenal power, and it's not something that's external to you, it's something that is within you, and that you can create a knowing about that. So I just always have this sort of imaginary conversation with the tribe, with my tribe, in which you finally have this recognition. When I talked to Dr. Maslow back in 1968 and asked him the question, what do you mean by self-actualization? And he said, all you have to do, Wayne, is learn to become independent of the good opinion of other people, and you'll have it. This is what they're like. This is how they're different from the rest of us, is that they are independent of the good opinion of other people. And if you get that down, and I always have an imaginary conversation with the tribe, in which I go to them and say, I have finally figured out what I need to do to actualize myself and to fulfill my purpose and to fulfill my divine mission and why I am here, my heroic mission, to express the spirituality that is within me, to express the God force that is within me, rather than this physicalness that I represent. But I am something much grander than that. And so what I've learned, members of the tribe, is that I have to become my individual, and I have to And I have to honor what you have taught me, but I have to leave you behind. And I have to go my own direction. And I know that's not going to sit well with the rest of you, but it doesn't make any difference. Because I now know that I have to listen to that inner voice. And even though you're all turning left, I got to make a right turn. And imagine this meeting of the tribal elders hearing this little conversation that you have just laid on them. And what do they say? How do they respond? No way. The purpose of the tribe is to keep you in part of the unit and to keep you from having such crazy ideas, because the tribe cannot survive without you. So it's like what you have to do is leave the tribe. And now I have left the tribe. I've been out of the tribe for 40 years almost. Truly, I have. But everybody in the tribe thinks I'm in the tribe. They do. There's not one person in my tribe, whether it's my individual family or extended family, who thinks that I'm not a member. They think that I'm really right with it. But I have nothing to do with the tribe. In consciousness, in my awareness, I know that the rest of the tribe doesn't know a thing about turning right. They're not ready to turn right. When they come to a fork in the road, as Yogi Berra said, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. And when they go the path that is most familiar, the one that is paved. And going in the unpaved paths is not something that... So it's like tribal consciousness is something that is very important for you to... seminar this program today is about this idea of manifesting your destiny and coming to a inner kind of awareness that I have within me this power to do that, to actualize. And everything that Jesus said they're capable of doing in ourselves, I am capable of doing. And I am leaning into that. By the time we're finished, hopefully you will have a kind of an idea of how to go about making that happen. I will be talking about what I consider these. But before I get into them, I'm going to share with you the state of mind that I was in when it seemed to me that it was obvious that I was going to now begin writing about this idea. of being able to have to experience what they call in India, they call in Hindi Siddhi consciousness. S-I-D-D-H-I, Siddhi consciousness. Siddhi consciousness is a consciousness that you can reach, a state you can reach in your life, in which that there is no time lag between the having of the experience of having a thought and that the manifestation of that into the physical world. That's what Siddhi consciousness is. In other words, it's what, and in the West, it's called Christ consciousness, which is a consciousness in which is described in the Bible as the gift of the ability to feed the hungry from your consciousness, the ability to manifest food, because the awareness of being able to heal, for example, is stronger than the awareness within those who are hungry that they can't be fed. And that power, that internal knowing, becomes so powerful in certain individuals that they can literally shift around and change the rules. It's like if I divide the stage for the rest of the day, where everything on my right represents the physical world, the world of matter, the stuff that we can experience and see with our senses. That's all over here. And over here to my left represents the world that is the cause of this over here. The force that is in us, that is invisible. That everything that is in this physical world that we see and observe and notice has boundaries and certain experiences and expressions of matter and rules, beginnings and ends, boundaries, laws of motion, laws of gravity, all the stuff that we learn in school is over here. And over here is that invisible divine force, something is over here, that allows this to be this. And these rules over here, in this what we call the spiritual dimension, or the invisible, or the unseen dimension, are so strong and so powerful that if you embrace them and come to know them and begin to live them, they can alter the rules over here. They can literally shift these rules around and circumvent them. And I'll talk more about that very shortly. This idea of having within you this ability to go into this world over here and create this Christ consciousness, or this Siddhi consciousness, is one in which you no longer have forfeited your ability to oscillate back and forth between these two worlds. For most of us, it's because our anchor is, our body rather, is really anchored, and our life is anchored over here. And felt, after he read it, that I was a person in the West who could teach this manifesting technique, which we have put out into this CD that Guy was talking about, called Meditations for Manifesting. And it's a meditation practice that you do each and every day, morning and night. And I'll explain it a little bit at the end. Maybe we'll even do a few moments of it for those of you who aren't familiar with it. But what he said to me in this tape and in this letter was, do it. Do it for 15 days. Just practice this meditation and banish and get rid of all of the doubt that you have. And I get tapes like this all the time. I get people sending me, you know, all kinds of stuff. Stick a crystal in your ear and, you know, and something great will happen. And other places and other things. I mean, it's I get lots and lots of this stuff. But this wasn't like that. And I listened to it and I took it home and my wife and I did it. We went together at the beach. I talked to other people, friends about it and so on. And these wonderful, strange things began to just show up. And I thought, this has something to do with where I'm going, you know. And what it really involves is having the, this is church, Wayne, having the chutzpah to go within and feel that perhaps the fear that the ego says not capable of doing this because we and God are separate from each other. It has to do that in order for it to survive, because the ego's greatest fear is that you'll come to know God and realize that you are God. And God is within you. Defined ego as edging God out, you know, E-G-O, edging God out. And I think it's really a good acronym because it's really, it thrives, this idea, but on believing that you and God are separate. And when I read this information, I began to listen to it, and I thought, you know, I have within me, according to all that I have read, I have within me this power to heal myself and others. And I have within me I mean, I don't really believe that doctors heal people. You know, I mean, you cut your hand and you watch it, and you don't need a doctor to heal it. You just have to watch it, and your nature heals it. Your very essence heals it. It just closes up, and before long, a scab forms. Nobody has to. No scab person has to come in and put one on. You know? It just starts healing, and then the scab falls away. And the body is the hero. I mean, and this force, this universal force that's in there is the hero. And so it's like you have that within you, the healing capacity. You've healed yourself thousands of times with all of the little wounds and so on. The reason that most people don't heal in their lives is because they're bonded to their wounds of their past. You know, so you hang on to these wounds that are back here, and you lead with them, and you remind everybody about how horrible your life was, and that you're an alcoholic, and that you're the child of abuse, and that you're a victim of incest, a survivor, and that you're, you know, you lived in an orphanage, and that your father was an alcoholic, and that your mother liked your sister better, and that you were, you know, you got a million, there's a million of them. I got a million of them. Everybody's got a million of them, you know. And we lead with them, and whenever anybody doesn't pay enough attention to us, whenever our ego gets really worked up, and we feel that our self-importance isn't being acknowledged by enough people, we just haul it out. We haul out our wounds. But how can you talk to me like this? Don't you know what I am and what I've been through? And very often I'll meet people, and within 10 minutes of being in their company, I know about all of the horrors of their life. And they wonder why they don't heal. Because your biography, of course, becomes your biology, becomes the cell tissue of your life. And if you hang on to this stuff over here, it's like if you had a wound, you cut your hand and you had a wound, and that wound didn't close, you wouldn't let it close. Every time it tried to close, you opened it. Now you ain't closed. No way. I'm keeping you right here. Well, I got, this is something I can really use. I got a lot of power I can use. And you just kept opening this thing, you know. Your body would die. You couldn't, it would just get infected and it would die. Because your nature says, close the wounds. Except when it comes to the wounds of our past, which we understand make us stronger. And are things we had to go through in order to get here today. So, we hang on to these things. And one of the wounds that we hang on to is this idea that somehow I am not trustworthy. I am not valuable. I am a sinner. I am evil at my core. I am not really a genius. I am not capable. I do not have God within me. I don't have esteem. I'm not valuable. And we hang on to this idea. And then when the time comes for us to really, when we have the opportunity presented to us to really move in another direction and to make the changes, we haul out our wounds. And we not only keep ourselves from moving towards this highest level of awareness that I'll be talking about later on, but it also keeps us in a pattern of self-abuse, whether it's physical or mental or emotional. It keeps us stuck back there with things like addictions, with things like depressions, with things like arthritis, with things like heart disease, with things like compulsive eating disorder, with things, you know, like anxiety, and so on. All of this stuff that we think is just stuff that happens to us. And we don't really ever stop and say, thank you for all of this. We don't do that. And so these opportunities present us, this idea of learning to leave the tribe and to not go along and to not do what is expected of you by all of the rest of the people. You have to be willing, when you talk about self-actualizers, when you talk about people who reach this highest level, and it is, make no mistake about it, it is at this highest level that goes beyond just merely surviving and just taking care of your bills and just functioning and doing all the things that you do in your life. I would suggest that of all the people that are here today, and it looks like 1,000 or so here today, I would suggest that all of you wouldn't come here and spend a Saturday afternoon if you didn't have inside of you some kind of a knowing that there is a deeper and a richer experience of life available to you and to all of us, and that this might just be something that is going to help me to actualize that. That you know this. You may not be sure of exactly what path or how to go about doing it, but you vote when you come to something like this. or any of the people that come here to the church. I mean, the top people in this spiritual revolution. And what do you think this spiritual revolution is about? I mean, I was a school teacher. Marianne Williamson was a singer, a lounge singer. Louise Hay was a dancer. Deepak Chopra is a physician. Bernie Siegel is a physician. Larry Dossey is a physician. Og Mandino is a salesman. These people are people who came up from here rather than having it imposed down here. And creating this kind of an inner awareness that you are not going to be stuck as a member of the tribe really means letting go of all that you have attached yourself to as what it is that is important for you. It means taking an eraser, if you will, almost to that path. See, often we know, we think that we know, and I've talked before about the difference between what you believe and what you know. If I had managed to gather the 1,000 people in the metropolitan Detroit area today on Saturday afternoon who had never seen a bicycle before and got you all here and you'd never seen this thing and I put it up here on the stage and I were to show you this thing and say to you, okay, I know this looks weird, but this is a form of transportation. And you see that little seat? And you see your seat? And you see those little wheels? And you're going to get on that thing. And you're going to pedal it. And it's not going to fall over. And you're going to balance yourself, and it's going to really improve your mobility in your life. You would all go, wait a second, hold it, 1 second. I can't get on that thing. That thing isn't going to get me around. And if I brought in all kinds of people from behind here to testify, I love that, especially in church. Testify. And they all testified and told you how great this new way of moving about the planet was and how great this was. And you can all do it. Yes, absolutely, you can do it. And then I brought in a whole group of people to get on that thing and ride it around. And I showed you movies of it. And I gave you a lecture on the laws of motion and balance that allow you to do it. And then I got it on myself and I rode around the room on it. And I put it here. I said, okay, one at a time. Come on. Get on this thing and ride it. You would approach it always with an element of doubt. Until you had the conscious contact or the direct experience of it, in which then you would have a knowing. So when I speak of knowings and beliefs, I'm speaking about the difference between having doubt and not having it. And when you have a knowing about something, that knowing becomes so strong that all doubt has been banished. And as it says in the Course, I think probably the most quoted piece in the Course in Miracles says, if you knew, not if you believe, but if you knew who walked beside you at all times on this path that you have chosen, you could never experience fear again. If you knew it, which means it's the difference between knowing about God, which is a belief, and knowing God, which is a knowing, which is a conscious contact and a banishment of doubt. And it is this knowing that you are not alone, that who you are is not that which is stuck over here, but who you are is something much more divine and grand than that. And knowing that, and when you have that knowing, then you can retreat. And as you retreat and let go, you allow yourself to become that manifester. And to understand this universal force, whatever you want to call this universal force, whether it's the divine mind or universal intelligence or the organizing intelligence, but you know that it's in all things. It's not a separate God for you and a separate one for you and a separate one for you. We all know that this universal, which means one, una, one, this universe, this one song, is in all things and all of us. It is what allows this over here to be. And as you come to know this, you have to understand the implication of that universal intelligence. What does that mean? If it is every place, it means that it is. There is no place that it is not. Right? Which means it does not individualize or particularize into an individual personality. It is just there for in all things. If you instantly say that this God force particularizes into an individual, what you're saying is that then there's some place that it's not. If it's in this but not here, then it's no longer universal. So it can't do that. And as you come to ask yourself this question, if I knew that I had the ability to manifest what it is that I would like to be able to manifest for myself in my life, if I knew this, which is an absolute banishment of all doubt, and I knew that I had this power, what would it be? What would you manifest? Would you rid yourself of an addiction? Would you manifest for yourself wealth, a healing, a divine relationship, prosperity, abundance, health, a job, a promotion, a child? Whatever it is that you would instantly think of, ask yourself, and then just set it aside, what is it within me that keeps me from doing it? You see, this is really the crux. Everything that you process or perceive to be missing from your life that you would like to be able to manifest has within it the same organizing divine intelligence that is in you. So when you learn to manifest, which we're going to do today, and I'll give you those principles, when you are learning to manifest, what you are really doing is aligning your intention with divine intelligence. Or another way of saying it is, you are manifesting another aspect of yourself. Of yourself. That divine force that is everywhere is in all things, including that which is missing from your life. So it's really just a matter of how do I get it to show up. It's already here. We are not about the business of creation. Everything that's in the physical world is here. We're in the business of distribution and shifting around and transformation. We don't create new dust, new molecules, new atoms. They're all here. The universe is complete in the physical sense. It's just changing. It's going from one thing to the next, to the next. So that what you are about is just aligning that intention with what it is that you would like to see show up. And there are certain things that you do. And when you do them and practice them and know them, I guarantee it. Money back guarantee. You buy that CD, you practice this manifesting meditation, it doesn't work, you send it back to me, I'll send you your money. Because I don't get anything for it anyway. I can't take money for it. That's one of the things I was told. So what I get from that goes to finding a cure for AIDS. And thank you. One of the things that I tell audiences is that today, I have gone beyond my attachment to this physical being. I've left that behind. And my work from here on in is really solely about letting go of my ego and my self-importance. But back to this idea of what is it that we can do to get out of the tribe without letting the tribe know that we've left. The tribe has to understand that they think that you're still a member. And that's all okay. It's inside, in that inner world, that you absolutely have this knowing. One of the things, one of the principles, one of the parts of the principles that I've written about in this Manifest Your Destiny book is that you don't share what you want to manifest with anyone. The minute that your ego gets involved.
This concludes Side A. Please stop the tape and turn it over to continue the program on the other side.